Assalamu alaikum. First, let me take the opportunity to thank the Palestinian Student Association at Colorado University for inviting me to address the campus community at this most difficult period in our history. Indeed, we have been in the middle of holidays, and when we speak of holidays, we had the end of Ramadan, and we had Thanksgiving, possibly one of the worst weeks for animals. End of Ramadan is often slaughtering sheep in celebration, and Thanksgiving, the turkey is running scared. And we're moving our way into the end of the year, so thank you for indulging me at this point to address such an important topic, which is the new American empire and its adventures in the Middle East. When we speak about war and also speaking about holidays and events that are so important, it's important for us to reflect and remember all those who will spend these holidays without a father, a husband, a brother, a sister, a mother, or a close friend. And this includes Americans, Iraqis, Afghans, among many others impacted. Wars, aside from being part of the statecraft, in reality are about human beings, friend and foe alike. In death, all are equal, and none is victorious. Even though that we think that we are, it's often those who died are the ones that pay the dear price. In the introduction, it was stated that I am a Muslim, and I am, that I am a Palestinian, and I am a Palestinian. And I would like to say that I was against the war before it started, and continue to be so at this time. And I mentioned this in the beginning of my talk so everyone knows where I'm coming from, so nobody thinks that they're duped by someone trying to offer them an opinion that is contrary to where they are standing. So I say that I was against the war and continue to be so. Also, I say that I am a Muslim and a Palestinian, so I'm stating a position or reflecting an opinion that often goes unheard. And here I would like to possibly echo one of the statements that Henry Kissinger often was known to say, that Arabs always lie. So in this sense, you're going to hear a couple of hours of the construct of an Arab lies, and maybe I entertain you that the possibility of my lying might be a truth. And this is opposite to the construct that is often understood, that a Westerner point of view is truth with the possibility of a lie. And I'm stating this for you to begin to understand as I discuss a topic from a particular point of view that is not reflected in the mainstream sources. The title of my talk is The New American Empire and Its Adventures in the Middle East. And my hope is to provide you with a point of view that is absent from the mainstream as the march to war unfolded and the current attempt at obfuscating its major arguments by using raw patriotism and rallying around the flag as a way to keep everyone in line in supporting this war. While it might seem to be unconnected, I would like to take a few minutes of your time to remind myself and everyone in this hall of the loss of Edward Said. Professor Edward Said, who passed away on September 25th, 2003. How many people here know or heard of Edward Said? Edward Said as a Palestinian, and it is fitting to remember Said before speaking about the current American empire and the conflicts in the Middle East, for he has contributed toward a better understanding of the region and the people he loved dearly. I highly recommend his works for those who haven't read any of his material. Orientalism, a must read in this time and age. Culture and Imperialism, Blaming the Victim, Covering Islam, Politics of Dispossession, The Palestine Question, and his biography, Out of Place. It might be Out of Place as a fitting title for a number of books describing what was is underway in the Middle East. Also Out of Place could be a new title for the American presence in Iraq today, Out of Place. To begin with, look at what a British officer, and this is in harping back on what Said's Orientalism is about. A British officer who was assigned to Iraq said, in preparing himself to the deployment, quote, "I read T.A. Lawrence before I came here." T.A. Lawrence, those who don't remember, T.A. Lawrence was the British intelligence officer who fomented the Great Arab Rebellion. And for historians of the Middle East, know that the Great Arab Rebellion, it was not great, nor it was Arab. It was British intelligence operation that fomented the rebellion in the Hijaz, which is current-day Saudi Arabia, as a way of cutting the Ottoman troops in half and cutting the Arab provinces from the Ottoman to allow the British to land at the shores of the Mediterranean in Palestine. So this British officer is preparing himself for the deployment by saying, "I read T.A. Lawrence before I came here." He said, quote, "A century ago, he recognized dishonesty was inherent in Arab society. Today is the same," he says. "They do nothing for love and nothing at all if they can help it." This was in the UK Guardian, October 20th, 03. Said Orientalism possibly can still help us in challenging our basic understandings and assumptions about the Arabs and Muslims, who seem to be ever more menacing and threatening in our public discourse. We do have to admit the existence of a deep-rooted Arab and Islamophobia, which, according to Neil Clark of The Guardian, has been part of Western culture since the Crusades, with Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden only the latest in a long line of Arab boogeymen. For centuries, the Arab has played the role of a villain, seducer of our women, hustler and thief, the barbarian lurking at the gates of civilization. Clark comments that, quote, "In the 20th century, new images emerged, the fanatical terrorist, the stone thrower, the suicide bomber. Now, as the project for the new American century suffered its first major setback in the back streets of Baghdad and Basra, Arab and Islamophobia has been given a new lease of life. Policies, war, and civilizational projects cannot function without a constant level of public support. And if it is not present, then it has to be produced. The current propaganda machine works on the basis of an already existing reservoir of racism directed at Arabs and Muslims permeating the society, thus making it possible for the public to rally around the leadership when Arabs and Muslims are the target." Some argue that Professor Said was able single-handedly to reshape the field of humanities and social sciences, but don't say this to Congress or to establishment embedded intellectuals. We do understand the role of embedded journalists, i.e. journalists who were in bed with power during the Gulf War and during the invasion of Iraq, and we should be aware of the role of the in-bed intellectuals. Take the Orientalist par excellence, Bernard Lewis, who is a favorite White House and Pentagon specialist on the Middle East, and his many disciples. Lewis and his disciples offer recommendations, often in private or meetings with top officials at the Pentagon and the administration. Bernard Lewis' prescriptions for the Middle East, he calls for direct recolonization of the Arab world, while disregarding Arab public opinion, including that of the so-called moderates who support America. This is Bernard Lewis' view. "The Arabs will always be ruled by tyrants." That's his statement. "The Arabs will always be ruled by tyrants," he told a Pentagon briefing recently. "So we better make sure that they are friendly ones," meaning the tyrant, friendly to us. "Arab anger against America has nothing to do with its policies. Arab anger against America has nothing to do with its policies," meaning the policies of America. "So the U.S. must not try to appease the Arabs by leaning on Israel or by reversing some of its more belligerent and insensitive policies in the region." The meaning is that there is no cause and effect between Arab anger and hostilities on U.S. policies and the reactions that they have. This premise is that the Arab is an irrational actor, and this irrationality has to be dispensed with, so you don't have to pay attention to Arab public opinion, even those who are friendly to us. To keep the field open for himself, Bernard Lewis and his disciples, he called for a congressional hearing, urging the Congress to have a hearing on Title VI funding for 17 centers for Middle Eastern studies, and an attack was mounted on the purported anti-American programs. The argument is no longer about what the students should be taught, but about what they should not be taught. Some of the names in the hearing that were mentioned, students should not be taught or permitted to read Edward Said or Robert Fisk or Arundhati Roy. And above all, Middle East scholars must be discouraged, actually, from learning Arabic. Now, here's a novel idea, to be a specialist in the Arab world without knowing Arabic. It is of a Chinese being an expert on English literature and not having to learn, speak, write in the English language. It will be something completely unacceptable in any intellectual discourse, let alone be allowed to be part of a hearing in Congress and goes unchallenged by anyone. The new colonial power, which hopes to encounter its first major success in Iraq, is one that does not apparently believe that knowledge is power, but certainly hopes that ignorance is. Like Karl Marx, they also believe that in the Middle East, the weapon of criticism must now be replaced with the criticism of weapons. If the Middle East does not conform to its description in Orientalist texts, then why not bomb it into submission and shape? We will have to wait and see how this prescription of Bernard Lewis and his disciples work out itself in Iraq. The omens so far from Baghdad, Fallujah, Karbala do not look good for a revived Orientalism. In the hearing, another fervent critic argues, for two decades now, ever since America's program in Middle Eastern studies were taken over by Edward Said's post-colonial studies paradigm, the American Academy has been busy undermining America's security, not enhancing it. He laments, where are the professors with a strong sense of national interest? Lots of knowledge acquired in the field, good intelligence connections, a willingness to recruit their students, and an eagerness to serve in times of war. No such person exists in Middle Eastern studies. And we say, thank God. And all this because Said has browbeaten scholars into submission to his warped scholar's vision, according to this critic. So what you see in here in this hearing in Congress, it seems a new charge for professors engaged in Middle Eastern studies and Islam has been given. This charge is to acquire knowledge for the purpose of national interest, not for the purpose of knowledge itself. To develop in their academic pursuit intelligence connections, meaning to be either a researcher or advisor or somewhat connection to the intelligence network in the U.S. Third, instead of grading the students' work an A, B, or C, it is to grade them whether they are more apt to join the CIA, FBI, or any of the intelligence network, since it's a willingness to recruit their students is something that is being given as a charge for the funding. Now, I'm not here concerned about students interested in joining any agency or any field of study on their own, but to give the charge to the professors to be engaged in such pursuit, harking back to what the Russians used to do under the Soviet Union. It seems that we are trying to go toward that path. The new American empire and its adventures in the Middle East, as you see as your guest today, you'd allow me to go beyond what might be only comfortable and within your safety zone and engage in analysis of our collective crisis. We are in the middle of an empire building phase. It is global and impacting every human being on the face of this ship we call Earth. Everyone in the world is impacted by empire. We have the power to impact people's lives the world over more than their collective ability to impact ours. Under the guise of war on terrorism, some have advanced the notion of a new American empire, and it's important for us to expose the few who for sure are unelected but will impact all of our lives for the foreseeable future. Since we are in Iraq to stay, as those pundits have said, we are in Afghanistan to stay, and in some 37 new countries since 9/11. We have deployed U.S. forces in 37 new countries since the events of 9/11. Most of these countries had no connection whatsoever to Osama bin Laden. Georgia has no Arabs living in it, and had no connection to Osama bin Laden. We deployed troops in Georgia. The new American empire and its thinkers have been at work for the past 20 years. They've been working through the years to bring into fruition not some conspiracy, but diligent work inside and outside circles of power and influence. In my view, the new American empire has been shared by four major forces that are intertwined and hardly could be separated at this present time. One is the neoconservatives. Second, Israeli-centric individuals in the U.S. belonging to both parties, Republican and Democrat. The messianic fundamentalist Christian right. And fourth, the global oil interest. Let's take each of these strands and highlight their interest in bringing about regime change in Iraq and possibly other places in the Middle East as being part of the new empire. Neoconservatives' emergence on the scene is rather recent, and the ascendancy of their agenda is directly related to events of 9/11. The neocons took the 9/11 events as a sign for them to advance already constructed worldview. Their writings on U.S. foreign policy go back to the early 70s, but it was always seen, even by traditional conservatives, as a far-fetched right-wing agenda that doesn't belong in the mainstream of American foreign policy discourse. When we speak of the neocons, then we have to account for their Washington-based institutions and think tanks, which played a key role in shaping U.S. response in post-9/11 and the eventual invasion of Iraq. Some of these institutions are the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, the American Enterprise Institute, the Project for New American Century, the Heritage Foundation, the Middle East Forum, the Committee on the Present Danger, Center for Security Policy, Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, to name the obvious few. While addressing the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. on February 23rd of this year, President Bush proclaimed, "You are some of our country's best brains, that my government employs around 20 of you." This is in relation to the American Enterprise Institute. "You are some of our country's best brains, that my government employs around 20 of you." The neocons were in a very good position with an already developed plan that was put into action after 9/11. For they can say, "We told you so," and indeed they did. Their ideas are built upon a paradigm of power. Might makes right type of thinking. Their idea for U.S. foreign policy is preemption as a defining outlook for U.S. foreign policy, unilateralism in foreign policy, which we saw its fruits in the Iraq invasion, increasing military spending to 3.8% of GNP, which next year will be about $401 billion, recommitting ourselves to actual nuclear weapons development, small and strategic types of nuclear weapons, opposition to the 1972 Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, and the Chemical and Biological Weapons Conventions, pulling back from global environmental treaties. These have been the defining characteristics of the neocon policies as they advocated by the Bush administration. We are in the middle of an empire-building phase, and it is one vested in power, might, and awe. Senator William Fulbright, in 1966, wrote, quote, "Power has a way of undermining judgment, of planting delusions of grandeur in the minds of otherwise sensible people and otherwise sensible nations." To remind you, in 1964, Senator Fulbright led the debate in favor of the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, but became one of his strongest opponents, of the war after discovering that it was a total fabrication, just as the case today with the Iraq buildup and the invasion. Recently, as the false nature of the buildup to war became apparent, the administration has decided to sing the democracy song. And the new theme for the president, foreign policy approach, in reality, it's only a tool to once again rally public support around an already failing Iraq policy. So rather than focusing on the failure of the Iraq policy, now we want to bring democracy to the rest of the Middle East. At this point, I have to say what the Middle East experts, quote-unquote, are required to say in the current public debate. We do need democracy in the Middle East, and the authoritarian structures and regimes must be changed. It is an empty and false construct brought about for the purpose of an existing Iraq policy. Thus, the terms of the debate are already defined to rally public support, and experts begin to engage on an already controlled boundary of engagement. Power has the ability to define the terms of the debate and often also the modes of dissent from its construct. Now, this doesn't mean that there isn't much work to be done in the Middle East. There is. And that doesn't mean that there isn't much work to be done in the Muslim world. There is. But there is much work to be done also in this country. Coming to more serious matters about the neocons, the invasion of Iraq, we have to say, was cooked up in the now defunct Pentagon Office of Special Plans, which was staffed by Douglas Faith, and often with the help of the neoconservatives' favorite Iraqi exile, Ahmad Shalabi. This office cooked the most alarmist pre-war intelligence against Saddam Hussein, and then piped it to the White House via Rumsfeld and Vice President Dick Cheney, and fed it by the intelligence agencies. It was also his office that was in charge of post-war planning, to the exclusion of all others, and rejected the product of months of work by dozens of Iraqi exiles and Middle East experts in the State Department and the Central Intelligence Agencies, who anticipated, actually, many of the problems that have wrong-footed the occupation. The Office of Special Plans also excluded many top Middle East experts from the State Department from playing any role in the coalition provisional authority in Iraq. Recently, there has been a shift in the Bush administration that Condoleezza Rice was assigned responsibility away from the Pentagon hands because of their failure. This operation and policy came from the Pentagon. In a just published article, December 1st, 2003, issue of the American Conservative, titled, quote, in Rumsfeld's shop, a senior Air Force officer watches as the neocons consolidate their Pentagon coup. Officer Karen Kiotowski says, quote, then we stepped into meet Deputy Undersecretary of Defense Bill Luthi. I knew Luthi had a PhD in international relations from the Fletcher School at Taft and was a recently retired Navy captain himself. At this point, I didn't know what a neocon was or that they had already swarmed over the Pentagon, populating various hives of policy and planning like African hybrids with the same kind of sting reflex. Luthi just seemed happy to have me there as a warm body. Karen was responsible for the Africa desk in the Pentagon, and she was given as a lone desk person for Bill Luthi, and at that point she discovered early on the various neocons that were populating various policy-making positions within the Pentagon. Karen goes on to observe, quote, I came to share with many colleagues a kind of unease, a sense that something was a worry. What seemed out of place was the strong and open pro-Israel and anti-Arab orientation in an ostensibly apolitical policy generation staff within the Pentagon. There was a sense that politics like these might play better at the State Department or the National Security Council, not the Pentagon, where we considered ourselves objective and hard-boiled. Furthermore, Karen says, the anti-Arab orientation I perceived was only partially confirmed by things I saw. Toward the end of the summer, we welcomed to the office, as a temporary special assistant to Bill Luthi, an Egyptian-American naval officer, Lieutenant Commander Yusuf Abul-Ainain. His job wasn't entirely clear to me, but he would research bits of data in which Bill Luthi was interested and peruse Arabic language media for quotations or events that could be used to demonize Saddam Hussein or link him to a nastiness beyond his own borders and with unsavory characters. Now we do understand that the intelligence information that was supposedly collected came up from the Office of Special Plans of Douglas Faith, and much of it was fabricated or passed on by Ahmed Chalabi and the Iraqi National Congress. The inside hold of power staffed with neocons and an outside cabal was also in existence. Outside the administration, the neocons involved in the project for the new American century kept the pressure up through press releases, conferences, and lectures, using all the same usual list of speakers. The Iraqi National Congress, a group that had no mentioned following inside Iraq, was selected by Richard Pearl and the neocons to be the flag bearer for the Iraq plan. As late as 1998, the CIA assessment of the Iraqi National Congress is their lack of support inside Iraq, and Ahmed Chalabi was considered to be corrupt by professionals involved in studying the situation. We managed thereafter to pump about $70 million into the Iraqi National Congress. A good PR campaign, post-9/11, and all the news that fit to print, including that of Thomas Friedman and the New York Times, and you have a national movement to partner with in the liberation of Iraq. The Iraqi National Congress was our creation, just like T.A. Lawrence created the Great Arab Revolt. The project for new American century respected no borders and sovereignty is only contingent on services rendered to the empire's project. This stands as the biggest con job of the century. No play on the neocon here. Yet no real investigation has been undertaken. We took Clinton to task for the Whitewater deal. I'm not a Democrat, but we took Clinton to task for a Whitewater deal that gained him $100,000 before he was president. Now we have a president who took the country to war on false pretexts and fabricated evidence, and still we are waiting for a real investigation and a real hearing to take place. Now, I know some will say, well, you're an Arab. What are you talking about? This is our country. Well, this is a country of immigrants, and I pay taxes in this country. It is my country as well, and he is my president, and he has to be accountable. I hope that no one in this room still believes that the Bush administration pre-war announced cause belli. Iraq did not pose an imminent threat. To Saudi Arabia, that is, or any of its next door neighbors. Because one of the logic says that Iraq was an imminent threat. The nuclear weapon is about to be developed. The chemical and biological weapons in the State of the Union of the Bush State of the Union, they have tons and tons of chemical and biological weapons. So it was an imminent threat. The threat of Iraq on the United States ranks high up there with that posed to the United States by the likes of Nicaragua and the great threat of Grenada in the mid-80s, which we invaded. Weapons of mass destruction are nowhere to be found, and bringing democracy to the region also rank high with the many democracies we managed to prevent in much of the Third World, Florida notwithstanding. Michael Moore had the best line in the Oscars. This is a fictitious war. In a statement at the Senate floor, October 17, 2003, Senator Robert Byrd, one of my heroes, quote, said, "Taking the nation to war based on misleading rhetoric and hyped intelligence is a travesty and a tragedy. It is the most cynical of all cynical acts. It is dangerous to manipulate the truth. It is dangerous because once having lied, it is difficult to ever be believed again. Having misled the American people and stampeded them to war, this administration must now attempt to sustain a policy predicated on falsehoods. The president asked for billions from those same citizens who know that they were misled about the need to go to war. We misinformed and insulted our friends and allies. And now this administration is having more than a little trouble getting help from the international community. End of quote. The Iraq operation has more to do with ushering in a new American empire, or as the neoconservatives who cooked this up, and they like to refer to it by the project for the new American century. Neoconservatives chose to declare the birth of the American empire on the sands of the Middle East, not dissimilar to Napoleon's expedition in the late 18th century and the British at the turn of the 20th. You ask, why Iraq and why the Middle East? Because really we are dealing with a rather weak folk, ever more susceptible to conquest and lacking in internal cohesion between ruler and ruled. No one had any illusion that the Americans would win the war against Iraq. It is akin to having the Super Bowl champion, Tampa Bay, playing against a high school football team without cleats, without uniform, without a coach, without any help from the sideline, and the whistle is blown, and expecting the high school team to mount a challenge to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. The neocons are all well connected also to the military-industrial complex, which makes the new empire with its unending war a good engine for the economy. The military-industrial complex economy, that is, not any other part. As you see, this is a whole topic unto itself, but no one should feel comforted that the only part of the budget that is increasing is that of the military, at a time when we spend more money on military than the next 20 countries below us on military expenditure. To this end, we must be reminded by Dwight Eisenhower's farewell address in 1961. In the councils of governments, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for disasters, rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Many of the neoconservatives' personalities are also connected to many of the board of directors, advisory boards of companies that engage in the military-industrial complex, as well as those engaged in oil, which we will cover later. Moving from the neoconservatives to the second aspect of my talk, which is the Israeli-centric cabal in Washington. Before embarking on this, I would like to share with you a quote from the former Joint Chiefs of Staff. Former Joint Chiefs of Staff Admiral Thomas Moore, in a statement quoted in press in December 1, 1999. It is important for us to contemplate his statement before discussing this second point. He said, quote, "I have never seen a president, I don't care who he is, stand up to them, the Israelis. It just boggles your mind. They always get what they want. The Israelis know what's going on all the time. I got to the point where I wasn't writing anything down. If the American people understood what grip those people have on our government, they would rise up in arms. Our citizens don't have any idea what's going on." Now, this is not a very light person. This is a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Thomas Moore. I'm using his quote because often when you use this, the brush of anti-Semitism is used, and that you are creating an alarmist view of the influence that the Israeli-centric individuals play in foreign policy pertaining to the Middle East. Who are these Israeli-centric people? Douglas Faith, the one we spoke about earlier, has long opposed territorial compromise by Israel. He was an outspoken foe of the Oslo process, and even the Camp David peace agreement mediated by former President Carter between Egypt and Israel. His former law partner, L. Mark Zell, is a spokesman for the Jewish settlers movement on the occupied West Bank. But more to the point, virtually everything that has gone wrong in Iraq, especially those matters that Congress is either investigating or poised to probe in the future is linked directly to his office. All roads lead to faith, noted one knowledgeable administration official this week. I refer to these neoconservative ideologues in and outside the administration as Israeli-centric in their view and policy recommendation for the Middle East. They are Israeli-centric in their view and policy recommendation for the Middle East. In their view, all roads in the Middle East must lead to or through Israel, and if these roads don't, then bomb it, goes the logic of the neoconservatives. Jim Loeb, in a very detailed article for the Press Service International on November 6, 2003, exposed Faith and Pearl connection to the Israeli right. Loeb states, quote, "Like Pearl, Faith has long taken a strong interest in Israel and its security. His father, Dilek Faith, a philanthropist and major Republican contributor from Philadelphia, was active in the military Zionist youth movement, Beitar, the predecessor of Israel's Likud party in Poland before World War II. It is interesting that both father and son have been honored by the Zionist Organization of America, which, unlike other mainstream Jewish groups in the United States, has consistently supported Likud positions and the settlement movement in the occupied territories and actively courted the Christian right. Faith also served with Pearl on the board of the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, JINSA, a think tank that promotes military and strategic ties between the United States and Israel. Faith first entered government as a Middle East specialist on the National Security Council under Ronald Reagan in 1981, but was abruptly fired after only 1 year. Pearl, who was then serving in the Pentagon as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security, hired him as his deputy, and a post he retained until leaving in 1986, founding Faith and Zell Law Firm. 3 years later, Faith was retained as a lobbyist by the Turkish government, and in that capacity worked with Pearl to build military ties between Turkey and Israel. In 1996, he participated in a study group chaired by Pearl and sponsored by a right-wing Jerusalem-based think tank that produced a report calling for incoming Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to build a strategic alliance with Turkey, Jordan, and a new government in Iraq. Let me repeat this. In a study group chaired by Pearl and sponsored by a right-wing Jerusalem-based think tank that produced a report for incoming Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to build a strategic alliance with Turkey, accomplished, Jordan, accomplished, and a new government in Iraq is underway. That would transform the balance of power in the Middle East in such a way that Israel could decisively resist to trade land for peace with the Palestinians or Syria. In 1997, in a lengthy article, A Strategy for Israel, published in Commentary magazine, Faith argued that Israel should repudiate the Oslo Accords and move to reoccupy those parts of the West Bank and Gaza that had been transferred to the Palestinian Authority. 2 years later, he and Pearl signed an open letter to President Bill Clinton calling for Washington to work with Shelby's Iraqi National Congress to oust Saddam Hussein. In May 2000, they signed a report calling for the United States to be prepared to attack Syria militarily if Damascus failed to withdraw its troops from Lebanon. What I'm pointing out is that they have a trail of documents, a trail of writing on the subject, and it's not something coming out of thin air. At this point in time, someone from the Israel-centric grouping will use the term anti-Semitism as a way to divert attention away from Israel. This is not about anti-Semitism. Rather, it is about a grouping that is Israel-centric in its view and currently is driving the U.S. foreign policy bus, toward the cliff, not dissimilar to those around Sharon, the Likudniks, driving the same bus with the same type of driver license issued at the Department of Preemption and Mike Makes Right. Who are these ideologues? Richard Perle in Washington, D.C. is actually described as the Prince of Darkness. Even those who know him call him the Prince of Darkness. So if your colleagues call you as such, what can I call you? Paul Wolfowitz, another of the neoconservatives, Israeli-centric. Bill Kristol, another neoconservative, Israeli-centric. Mike Ledeen, another neoconservative, Israeli-centric. Woodley, who was the ex-CIA director, another neoconservative, Israeli-centric. Paul Bremer, the current manager of the Iraq, another neoconservative, Israeli-centric. And Donald Rumsfeld, just to name the few that we often see on CNN. Richard Perle, among others, wrote a position paper, A Clean Break, offered for then-Prime Minister Netanyahu, that Netanyahu himself found it to be far-fetched and didn't adopt it. It did call for dealing with Iraq, Iran, and Syria. Iraq, as early as 1970, was seen as the security threat to Israel and possessed all ingredients to become a regional state of significance to possibly counter a balance to America's key ally and regional military force on the scene. The neoconservatives wanted to make the Middle East a safer neighborhood, not for the Arabs, for Israel, and prevent any real or perceived threat to our ally, real or manufactured. Is it logical that the security and well-being of a whole region, some 300 million people, is contingent upon the needs, real or manufactured, of one state that is occupying another people and has attacked numerous times its neighbors? The neoconservatives are often actually to the right of Sharon and the Israeli Likudniks on all issues relevant to Israel. And the main thesis of their security approach is to eliminate any and all real or potential future threats to Israel, which will then force the Palestinian to accept a Pantustan offer. It is not a war for Israel, but Israel does greatly benefit from it, and many in the leadership were fervently pushing for it in many congressional hearings, including Barak, Netanyahu, and a number of Sharon advisors who testified in Congress. Israel's security, mistakenly, is constructed as a subset of regional threats and not a function of its own making by its own continued occupation, building of settlements, and expansion of its territory at the expense of the Palestinians. In this sense, it's a classical shift of the blame, away from the real causes and shifting the attention of failure away from your internal structure to a distant terrain. Fragmentation of Iraq does benefit Israel, for it extends Israel's security border away from Jordan to possibly reach Iran, which, interestingly enough, is on the axis of evil list through the direct influence of Richard Perle. For a brief moment in early March, the media was alive with questions whether the U.S. is acting as Israel's proxy by invading Iraq. On network TV, Tim Russert asked Richard Perle, a high-profile advocate of removing Saddam Hussein, whether the proposed war would be serving U.S. interest and specifically about the link to Israel. Similar issues were raised in a New York Times op-ed piece by Bill Keller, Is It Good for the Jews, March 8, 2003, and in a Times news article on the subject, Divide Among Jews Leads to Silence on Iraq War, March 15, 2003. Also, Patrick Buchanan in the American Conservative, Whose War, March 24, 2003, raised the same question, and another article in Current Concern, The War in Iraq Conceived in Israel, February 2003. Activist Ali Abu Ni'ma lists three ways in which Israel could hope to gain by the Iraq War. First, it would eliminate Iraq as a potential rival in the region. Second, by increasing the already deep alienation between Arab and American societies, such a war would be good for Israel's long-term strategic relations with the United States. Third, the U.S. war against Iraq might give the government of Ariel Sharon cover to crack down even harder on the Palestinians and perhaps even implement mass expulsion of the Palestinians from the occupied territories. Now, it's interesting that many of the neoconservatives in their early periods were liberals who drifted to the right when the Democratic Party moved to an anti-war position in the 1960s. And concern for Israel also loomed large in their change, as political scientist Benjamin Ginsberg puts it, quote, "One major factor that drew them to the right was their attachment to Israel and the growing frustration during the 1960s with a Democratic Party that was becoming increasingly opposed to American military preparedness and increasingly enamored of third world causes, Palestinian rights as well. In the Reaganites' rights, hardline anti-communism, commitment to American military strength, and willingness to intervene politically and militarily in the affairs of other nations, neocons found a political movement that would guarantee Israel's security, which was one of the pillars of the Reagan administration. Thus, support for Israel is at the root of the neoconservative movement presently, which has risen to the top policy-making echelons of the U.S. government. As far back as the end of the first Gulf War, Paul Wolfowitz and Dick Cheney urged the adoption of a military plan to invade Iraq, but were blocked at the time by Colin Powell, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and General Norman Schwarzkopf. In February 1998, Wolfowitz and a host of neocons signed an open letter to President Clinton, which proposed bringing down Saddam Hussein. Once again, the Israel-centric individual will try to dismiss their contribution and work to help bring about the Iraq policy. We often can recall that a tiny Cuban community can lobby and exercise powerful influence over Cuban policy in Congress, even though they are at odds with otherwise influential farm lobby in this country. Similarly, the American Medical Association, we recognize its influence in shaping health policy in this country. The National Rifle Association, as a lobby group, we can recognize its influence in shaping the policy in relations to the bearing of arms. Similarly, when it comes to Middle East issues, the extraordinary power of the Zionist lobby has been a fact of life for many years, yet often ignored or dismissed. On the other hand, the U.S. would not venture on such a war if its leadership didn't see a clear political and strategic gains for itself. So what we have here is a partnership. The Israeli connection to the Iraq war was highlighted by the furor over Virginia Congressman Jim Moran's response in early March to a constituent question during a town hall meeting. He said, quote, "If it were not for the strong support of the Jewish community for this war with Iraq, we would not be doing this. The leaders of the Jewish community are influential enough that they could change the direction of where this is going, and I think they should." We repeat this. "If it were not for the strong support of the Jewish community for this war with Iraq, we would not be doing this. The leaders of the Jewish community are influential enough that they could change the direction of where this is going, and I think they should." However, he would have been on safer ground had he limited his remarks to the leaders of the Jewish community. Jews as a group, like all other groups, are split on the war. One poll taken shortly before the beginning of the war indicated that 59% of Jews supported the war, matching the rest of the country. But the congressman was correct and extraordinarily courageous in pointing to the leadership of the major Jewish organizations and suggesting that they could have blocked this war. As a 13-year veteran member of the House, Jim Moran has been around long enough to understand how political power on Middle East issues operates in Congress. War against Iraq has so isolated the United States and makes so little sense that were it not perceived as good for Israel, it would have had more difficult time arousing sufficient support in Congress. When Congressman Moran says that the leadership of the Jewish community is influential enough to change the direction of where this is going, he is stating a simple truth about the power of the Israeli lobby, which helps to explain the silence and timidity of the Democrats. The power of the lobby interests explain in part why many high-profile Democrats, such as Senator John Kerry, Hillary Rodham Clinton, Charles Schumer, Barbara Boxer from California, Northern California, and others voted to give President Bush the authority for war in October 2002. Despite the manifest recklessness of the venture, they understood the basic logic that opposition to perceived Israeli interests might well have a dramatic impact on campaign contributions. Since Jewish sources could reportedly donate 50% or more of the total receipts to the Democratic Party. So in here, the link between power, money, elections, and lobbies, it's a fact of life, and we're just stating a fact in terms of how the shaping of U.S. foreign policy in relations to the Middle East is heavily influenced by the desires of what is good for Israel and the Israeli-centric individuals who also happen to be also linked to the neoconservatives. Having discussed the two points, now we can move to the third element of this, these new developments for the new American empire. This has to do with the messianic fundamentalist Christian right or the evangelical right. The ascendance of the evangelical right into the center of decision-making policy in the U.S. is a subject that is worth our study and observation. The Christian evangelical right have always played a role in the southern states. But over the past 20 years, they have managed to become one of the most dominant political forces on a national level, and to a greater extent, overtook the reins of the Republican Party. We can all remember the Contract for America and Newt Gingrich, congressional majority, which for me at the time ushered in the Christian evangelical right into center stage, becoming the main engine for the Republican Party. Now, often when you discuss the issue of the Christian right, the focus often is on the moral issues, meaning issues of social context of abortion. But really, focus has to be also related to the foreign policy impact of the evangelical right. This current administration, is beholden to the evangelical Christian right. And in the post-9/11 period, the themes being articulated by the president and those around him are messianic in nature. President Bush himself defines the issues in great theological terms, good versus evil terminology, the axis of evil. These are terms heavily dependent on theological and biblical constructs. We can see if they are the evil ones, i.e. product of Satan, then we are good, i.e. God-like, and thus our war, unending war, respecting no borders, is sanctioned by God. Here I'm not discussing anybody's belief system, but we need to account for the marrying of politics and religion, which we often deal with it in relations to Islam, but not taking account of it as it's happening inside the United States. In the soon-to-be-published The Faith of George W. Bush, a sympathetic account of his religious journey, author Stephen Mansfield writes in the Advanced Proofs that in the election 2000, Bush told Texas preacher James Robison, one of his spiritual mentors, quote, "I feel like God wants me to run for president. I can't explain it, but I sense my country is going to need me. And I know it won't be easy on me or my family, but God wants me to do it." Mansfield also reports, quote, aides found him face down on the floor in prayer in the Oval Office. It became known that he refused to eat sweets while American troops were in Iraq. A partial fast seldom reported of an American president, and he framed America's challenges in nearly biblical language. "Saddam Hussein is an evil doer. He has to go," the author concludes. The Bush administration does deeply reflect its leader. And this means that policy, even in military matters, will be processed in terms of the personal, in terms of the moral, and in terms of a sense of a divine purpose that propelled the president to meet the challenges at this particular time. Once again, I'm not saying that the person should not have a moral compass. The person should have a moral compass. But where do you draw the line where that moral compass is, in terms of biblical text, manifesting in policy? Interestingly enough, the general leading the hunt for Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein has publicly declared in speeches that the Christian God is bigger than Allah, who is a false idol, and believe that the war on terrorism is a fight with Satan. It would be interesting to be in a room planning war against Satan. Lieutenant General William Jerry Boykin, the newly promoted Deputy Undersecretary of State of Defense for Intelligence, General Boykin has reportedly told Christian groups and prayer meetings that President George Bush was chosen by God to lead the global fight against Satan. We're not talking about an individual speaking outside. This is a person who is Deputy Undersecretary of State of Defense for Intelligence. Was chosen by God to lead the global fight against Satan. He told one gathering, "Why is this man in the White House? The majority of Americans did not vote for him. He is in the White House because God put him there for a time such as this." You could see possibly God was hanging on the Chad in Florida, wanting George Bush to be there. In January, he told Baptists in Florida about a victory over a Muslim warlord in Somalia who had boasted that Allah would protect him from American capture. "I knew my God was bigger than his. I knew that my God was a real God and his was an idol," General Boykin said. He also emerged from the conflict with a photograph of the Somalian capital, Mogadishu, bearing a strange dark mark. He has said, "This showed, quote, the principalities of darkness, a demonic presence in that city that God revealed to me as the enemy." Once again, we're not speaking about an individual on the campus circle. This is a person responsible for policy. On the Middle East, General Boykin told an Oregon church in June that America could not ignore its Judeo-Christian roots. "Our religion came from Judaism, and therefore Islamic radicals will hate us forever." Dynamics is pitting Christianity against Islam, which gets you people, you know, hyped up, and this is how to get the clash of civilization construct. In the same month, General Boykin told an Oklahoma congregation that Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein were not the enemy. "Our enemy is a spiritual enemy because we are a nation of believers. His name is Satan." The evangelical right has engaged in a 1040 campaign. You ask, what is a 1040 strategy or campaign, right? No, it's not the type of oil that they use for evangelical cars. 1040, 1030, 2050. The 1040 campaign refers to the countries between 10 degrees and 40 north latitude, which are majority Muslim, for the purpose of spreading the gospel. According to figures from the Center for the Study of Global Christianity at Gordon Cornwell Theological Seminary in South Hamilton, Massachusetts, the number of missionaries to Islamic countries nearly doubled between 1982 and 2001, from 15,000 to somewhere in excess of 27,000. Approximately one out of every two is American, and one out of every three is an evangelical. George Braswell Jr., a missions professor at the Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, says, "We're having more than probably ever before go out to people like Muslims." So in here, the link between the strategy and the evangelical right is reflected in the type of evangelical work being done or being carried out in the Muslim countries, 10 to 40 latitude. All these countries are high priority for sending individual to them. The link between religion and politics is a topic of discussion daily in reference to Islam, but not to the Christian evangelical right, and its emergence as a powerful group within the halls of power in the most powerful superpower in the world. In Western history, the marriage between politics and religion has not been to put it mildly, positive. We can bring attention to a number of examples: the Inquisition, colonialism, the white man burden and the conquest in Africa and the Americas, slavery, theologically supported by the concept of the curse of Ham, and the Holocaust of recent manifestation. The interesting developments also alliance that has emerged between the Christian right and the Israel-centric crowd, both Zionists and not. Politics does make strange bedfellows, but who would have imagined that the organized Jewish community would become a partner with a group that its history and present theology is filled with anti-Semitism? Even the basis of the partnership and promotion of Israel is a problematic concept. The theology goes something like this: the creation of Israel would hasten the return of the Messiah. And upon his second coming, the Jews either will have to convert to Christianity or those who refuse would be killed. The Zionists and Sharon people know this, and they are more than happy to give the benefit of a coalition 70 million strong and worry about the Messiah when he gets there, if he ever arrives. In this case, we have Christian messianic whites who carried Bush into the White House and beginning to see the Battle of Armageddon shaping up. Now, whether you believe in the Battle of Armageddon or not, that's something different than trying to bring that into fruition. People should not be in the business of trying to hasten Armageddon. If it comes, then you should run the other way. You should not be the one beating the drums for it to occur. In here, reality seems as confirming theology, or that theology is attempting to shape reality. So this configuration of the neoconservatives, the Israel-centric, and the Christian right have another component added to it in relation to the Middle East, and that gets us to oil. We are in the Middle East because the Middle East has oil. If the Middle East produced peanuts, no one would be interested. Maybe Jimmy Carter would be interested in investment, knowing that he was a peanut farmer in his early age. The presence of black gold oil and being the primary engine for the modern industrial complex. I would not be speaking to you today had it not been for oil. I took the plane, traveled from California to here by means of oil, took the car from the airport to the lecture hall, that's oil. I'm speaking to you through a microphone, that's oil. You're sitting in a classroom that has lights, that's oil. You're sitting on chairs that are made of fabric that developed from oil. Your feet are touching the ground that is made of oil. Your cars are all inside and outside are oil. And some of your best clothing, right? Some of our best clothing, you know, people in the 70s used to love this stuff when it came out. Polyester is oil. So what I'm basing is that almost every commodity that we have today has an element of oil in it, and the oil is the basic component within the current modern industrial complex. When asked about the real North Korean nuclear threat versus that of Iraq, Assistant Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz responded, possibly with the only truthful statement that I could track on him in relation to the Middle East. He said, "They are not sitting on a sea of oil." When he was asked about North Korea, which really had a nuclear program, it had a nuclear program, it's a real threat, he responded that the North Koreans, they are not sitting on a sea of oil. The logic is that we are in Iraq and in the Middle East because they are sitting on a sea of oil. The prize for the Second World War was not Eastern Europe, nor was it Western Europe. The prize of the Second World War for any strategic person was the Middle East by the admission of the United States administration from 1945 onward. They replaced the British in the Middle East and sitting on the strategic commodity that has the possibility of shaping the worldwide economy at any given point. Oil and our unending desire to consume more of it and support of a lifestyle that cannot be supported for a long period of time. We refuse to even have an economy SUV. I live in California. Almost every other place we have an SUV. People going from the house to Safeway to shop in an SUV. You don't need an SUV to go shop in Safeway. Walking would be good, right? And would reduce the rate of heart attack in many of our cities if we just walk to shop at Safeway, which often is down the block. But now also we have the Hummers. Who would ride in a Hummer, which is a tank, to go and shop at Safeway? It's just mind-boggling to see a Hummer going down the street, right, and parking in Safeway, which often takes two parking spots, right, to go and pick up a loaf of bread and a few groceries and come, and you think that you have what you call maybe the Saddam Hussein are going to attack the SUV. So this is a lifestyle that we have to begin to consider. We account for less than 1/20 of the world population, yet we consume more than 40% of the world's unrenewable resources. China with 22% of the world population consumes about 5% of the world's unrenewable resources. See, we are 1/20, consuming 40%. China is 22% of the world population consuming 5%. The reality is, no one is ready to change his or her lifestyle in this country. And thus, our country works to maintain this imbalance by means of military force and political manipulation. Even though we don't want to admit it, that is the crude reality. The old story in colonialism, which comes first, the soldiers or the companies? And is it possible these days to differentiate between the companies and the soldiers? Are the soldiers coming to protect the companies, or the companies are there before the soldiers? So in reality, our access to the oil is foremost in our planning in the Middle East. The second largest reserve of oil is currently present in the Caspian Sea. There is a rush to get the Caspian Sea oil out. There is a proposal for a number of pipelines to come out from the Caspian Sea. The cheapest, most cost-effective, and the shortest route for the Caspian Sea oil passes through Iran. However, the United States administration have resisted oil companies' proposals for this pipeline. So in here, the oil companies were dragged into the war, not actually the leading component of the war effort. And this is the point, I would say, the opposition to the war, even though it was highlighted is no blood for oil, in reality, the oil interest was more concerned and more attuned to trying to strike a deal with the Iranians, to strike a deal with the Iraqis, to bring the oil out. And here what I say is the ideologues of the neoconservatives and their Israeli-centric friends were far more interested in the invasion of Iraq rather than to try to allow the Iranians, which they wanted to sign an agreement for the pipeline, to come out. While we are rushing for the Caspian Sea oil, it is not because of our own supply, as anyone would know, that most of our oil comes from our southern neighbor, even though we are trying to bring democracy to Venezuela, right, recently. Most of our oil comes from the Western Hemisphere. In the new global dynamics, it's not enough for the United States, the neoconservatives' logic, it's not enough for the United States to control its own oil supply, but it also has to control the oil supply of its competitors. Its two major competitors, in terms of blocks, is the Europeans. They have no source of oil of their own that is enough to sustain their economic engine. They're heavily dependent upon Middle Eastern oil. And second is China and the Asian economic configuration. China itself has no source of oil for itself and heavily dependent upon the Middle East. In the long-term economic competition, we have to be able to have the leverage on both of our competitors, the neoconservatives' logic, vis-a-vis the oil resource. That's a problematic construct. Because China is rapidly moving to be the dominant manufacturer of consumer products and commodities the world over. We, on the other hand, are still vested in the military-industrial complex. Christmas is coming up, right? Who's going to give his wife or husband an M1 tanks as a Christmas gift? Who's going to give an F-16 and park it in the garage? Honey, come, I brought you an F-16 for Christmas. No one. Our biggest export to the world is military equipment and military hardware. While everyone is consuming Chinese manufactured goods and products, DVDs, Sony, and so on, that are assembled in China. And that has to do with the global economic dimension, which is shifting manufacturing overseas, and the shifting is to reduce costs for the multinationals. The multinationals, we know increasingly, they are multinational with the real term of the word, with the word having no nationality other than the mighty dollar. So in this competition, oil becomes a major leverage to have vis-a-vis the Chinese and the Asian economies as well as the European. So in here what we have is these are the four forces that are bringing this new American empire into shape. I want to go to a conclusion and then open it for a question and answer period. The ongoing war in Iraq at this particular time has moved into a guerrilla type of resistance. Any logical person could see that this is what is unfolding in Iraq at present day. The response is to say that it is isolated in the Sunni triangle. Historically, if you study guerrilla type of campaigns, it's always the center of conflict is always centralized around the capital city and the provisional areas around it. And often most of the country goes silent without any activities whatsoever. And therefore, we are stuck in a guerrilla campaign. Second, the political transition that is being discussed has more to do with the election interests here in this country rather than with the Iraqi requirements. The date of June is more for election campaign in this country, the re-election bid of the Bush administration, which needs to have some type of disengagement from Iraq, whether it's direct or perceived to the American public, to show that there is some type of progress for a few months until the election actually unfolds. And therefore, this transition is a manufactured transition that will not succeed at all. The third possibility is the election, the free election, and I don't think that anyone at this particular time is thinking of a free election in Iraq. What they are thinking about is controlled election because they don't want to give the Iraqis the free possibility of having a free election to choose their own leaders and their own political system. Why? If free election occurs in Iraq, most likely it will be a Shia government that will be more aligned to Iran, that will be opposed to U.S. long-term interests, and will be hostile to Israel. As Rumsfeld said when he was asked about that possibility, he said, it is not going to happen. Therefore, Rumsfeld already decided what kind of election the Iraqis will have. I think most likely we'll send them some of the election or voting machines that we used in Florida to make sure that the election outcome at least is guaranteed that the kind of person is elected most likely will be akin to Shalabi, who's already signed up the country before even he comes into the country itself. He's been outside the country since 1954, and yet he is our flag bearer for Iraq. Why? Because he's ready to sign on the dotted line on everything before he actually reads what is being presented to him. And therefore, this possibility of election, I would say we have to delay it or possibly it will be scrapped and put some type of a council that will be given greater quote-unquote autonomy, similar to what the British often have engaged in. And I think these discussions are undergoing. The fourth possibility, which was yesterday in New York Times, is to create three states. the northern state being Kurd, the southern state being Shia, and the center state being Sunni. Now, if you think that this is a good solution, just read the history of the division between India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, and also something that we constantly are dealing with, the situation in Palestine, which was based on creating the two-state structure in 1948. The theory is to starve out the Sunni triangle from resources, because the oil resources is in the south and in the north. And this is once again is predicated upon how to extricate the United States with the least amount of resources being committed. And here we're speaking about human beings, soldiers either dying in the conflict, and how to be able to do that. And the United States have not yet admitted its failure, its policy failure in Iraq, and it's trying to find a way to package it. If we see what happened in earlier periods, packaging something that is based on failure will only lead to compounded failure. And I think that's the direction we are headed, in compounded failure in relations to the policy in Iraq. I hope that I could have ended on a more positive note, but this is the reality that we are dealing with as the empire unfolds itself in the shores and the sands of the Middle East. My last conclusion will be to share with you something that I started with the British officer. The British officer said he read T.A. Lawrence, right, to prepare himself for the Middle East. Lawrence has always said that he's Lawrence of Arabia, and I would say that Lawrence was not Arab, he doesn't belong to Arabia. So he's just T.A. Lawrence of 10 Downing Street, and that's what we should describe him. He articulated why he engaged in the Great Arab Revolt, and it was not great, nor it was Arab, but that's another issue. He said his reason for engagements are the following. One, personal. I liked a particular Arab very much, and I thought that freedom for the race would be an acceptable present. The biographers say that Lawrence had a love relationship with a male Arab, and therefore he felt that this great Arab revolt would be a good, appropriate present for his beloved. Second, patriotic. I wanted to help win the war, and Arab help reduced Alembi's losses by thousands. The second is patriotic, meaning he wanted to reduce the losses of the British soldiers as they landed on Palestine shores to try to attack the center part of the Ottoman forces. So it was no concern for Arab freedom and liberation. Third, intellectual curiosity. I wanted to feel what it was like to be the mainspring of a national movement and to have some millions of people expressing themselves through me. And being a half-poet, I don't value material things much. Sensation and mind seem to me much greater. And the ideal, such a thing as the impulse that took us into Damascus, the only thing worth doing. So it's like self-exaggerations, intellectual curiosity on his behalf. Four, ambition. You know how Lionel Curtis has made his conception of the empire a commonwealth of free people. Generally accepted, I wanted to widen that idea beyond the Anglo-Saxon shape and form a new nation of thinking people, all acclaiming our freedom and demanding admittance into our empire. There is, to my eyes, no other road for Egypt and India in the end, and I would have made their path easier by creating an Arab dominion in the empire. Does it sound close to what is being discussed about, not on the personal level, but at least in terms of bringing freedom and including the Arabs race into the empire, and the intellectual curiosity by some of the neoconservatives that are in Washington. None of these neoconservatives, I would say, are not intellectuals. They really are intellectuals. They really are well-read. They have their mind. But once you marry intellect to power, the intellects tend to have to take a back seat, because your action becomes based on your ability to do. And your ability to do with power tend to suspend the possibility of alternatives to power. And that, I would say, possibly the most dangerous ramification of the period that we are seeing. Thank you for taking the time to listen, and I'll be more than happy to answer your questions.